You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Tim McMaster. Going around the American League East, the Blue Jays and Yankees playing a huge series north of the border with the Eastern Division crown on the line. Also, some sad news as Yogi Berra, the great Yankee, passes away at the age of 90. That's where we start things off, talking to Yankees reporter Brian Hoke. An emotionally draining week for Yankees fans, I think, both on the field and off. And let's start off the field. The news came across late Tuesday, early Wednesday morning that Yogi Berra had passed away at 90 years old. Obviously, one of the all-time great Yankees, one of the all-time great Major League Baseball players. What was your first reaction and thoughts when you had heard the news?
It's sad. You hadn't seen Yogi as much in spring training recently. You know, I always used to remember walking into Joe Torre's office and Joe Girardi's office, and you'd see Yogi's golf clubs had arrived from New Jersey, and then you knew that he was coming down. And he'd usually skip the first couple weeks of camp and come down when the games start. And when you saw that golf bag in the corner of the office, you always knew that something good was going to be happening in camp. And it was just cool getting to spend time with a living legend, an icon. Talk baseball with him. He was like a walking baseball encyclopedia. I think there's a lot that gets lost with the game over till it's over, all the malaprops, and people want to come away with the idea that Yogi was this big cartoon character. He wasn't. He remembered things from the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. He was sharp. You don't get to live that kind of life in baseball without being sharp. And he was he was at the ballpark, it was his favorite time. He used to love coming down, like I said, in spring training, be around the guys. Very approachable to the players, to the media, to everybody. Just a real treasure to have Yogi Berra around and even get to know him a little bit. And it's sad. It's sad to know that you're not going to see those golf clubs in the corner of the clubhouse ever again. But what a great life. What a great American hero. And just going over some of the stats and the stories, it's incredible to think that all happened to one guy.
And you mentioned the great stories, the great quotes, obviously, and all that stuff. But on the field, I mean, this guy holds World Series records that are never going to be broken. I think that maybe he lived so long that and played so long ago that maybe younger baseball fans don't realize how good a player he was and the numbers that he was able to post. And for a franchise that puts everything on winning and winning all those championships, nobody won more than Yogi Berra.
No, and that's something he used to rib Derek Jeter about. I remember when the Yankees won the World Series in 09, that was Jeter's fifth World Series ring, and Yogi would come up to him with this kind of impish grin and say, "All right, kid, you're halfway there." Because Yogi had 10 rings, he had one for each finger, and he was very proud of that. So even though I think we associate the number 8 with Yogi Berra, I think 10 is also a very important number. It certainly was to him. And it's hard to believe. I think that people look, he's been in the national spotlight for a half century now, and I think a younger generation knows him as the guy on the Aflac commercials who says, you know, they give you money, which is as good as cash. And Yogi was smart. He knew what the people wanted to hear from him. But you look at his playing career, he was incredible. This is a 3-time MVP. This is a guy you could not strike out. I was looking at his numbers from 1950, a year where he probably should have won the MVP award, by the way. Phil Rizzuto won it. He struck out 12 times the entire season. That's a week for some of the guys right now. So I think that it really is remarkable. And it's great that people are appreciating the career of Yogi Berra and looking at his terrific life. And, it's sad that it has to come on a day where he's passed away. But 90 years old, and I think that he certainly lived his life to the fullest. And, we're going to miss seeing him around, that's for sure.
And the news of Yogi passing came just hours after an unbelievable baseball game with the Yankees and the Blue Jays, as far as the late inning goes, at least, Brian. But it all ends on Tuesday night with Greg Bird coming through with yet another late inning home run, 3-run shot after the Yankees had given up the lead in the bottom of the ninth on a Deionor Navarro homer. Bird comes right back in the 10th. And he's making people forget that Mark Teixeira was on this team early in the season, I think, with the way he's playing.
Well, it's hard to believe that they've haven't really seemed to miss a beat. You can't ask for a whole lot more than what they've gotten from Greg Bird. I think that what they've gotten from the kids who have come up from the AAA Scranton Rail Riders. I mean, Luis Severino pitched six very good innings against an incredibly tough lineup. But then Bird to come through, 10 homers and just over 30 games, it's remarkable to see how quickly he makes adjustments. You don't see a whole lot of panic there. Even when he gets down two strikes, he's a professional hitter. And that's what people have been saying when he started the year in Trenton, got promoted up to Scranton. They said, this kid, he puts a quality at bat. He's advanced beyond his years. He's 22 years old, and you're doing this in the middle of a pennant race, in the middle of the Rogers Center, which is shaking and rocking and is as loud as I think you've heard it probably in 20 years, probably since the Joe Carter homer. I mean, this place was insane. And then for Bird to come up in that spot, and it did not feel like a game that the Yankees were going to win. It certainly didn't, especially when Navarro hits the homer off Miller. Bird brings him right back, and no, that's a huge win. Joe Girardi said that probably saved the season for them as far as winning the division. They're still leading the wild card chase, but if they're going to win the division, they have to have that game to keep those hopes alive.
Let's start with Tuesday night. Obviously, a huge series between the Yankees and the Blue Jays, but Tuesday night's game had everything you could want in a game, and all of that came from pretty much the eighth inning on. It was nuts. But Dionor Navarro, the huge home run in the ninth inning to tie it. Obviously, the Blue Jays end up losing this game in 10, but what a moment for Navarro, a guy that I think at one point in the offseason when Russell Martin was signed, didn't Navarro kind of want out of Toronto at one point?
Yeah, he did, and really for the first half of the season as well. I think he was kind of waiting for a trade because, you know, I think in his mind, and rightfully so, he deserved the starting job after the season he put together last year. You know, he had waited a long time for that opportunity to be an everyday starting catcher, you know, dating back to his time with the Rays, and it had been a number of years, and Toronto gave him that shot last year, and then obviously things didn't really work out for him this offseason because of Russell Martin. But, you know, you really can't say enough about, you know, the fact that, you know, even though Navarro did want a deal, he's never been a problem inside that clubhouse whatsoever. He's one of the most popular guys in there, and, you know, he's a perfect example of a guy who's kind of left the business at the door, and as every day when he's reported, it's just been the same guy that he was last year, and it speaks to the depth that the Blue Jays have. And, you know, he's done a really good job this year of filling in and making sure that Russell Martin gets enough rest. And, you know, you're seeing examples like that. And you know, last night's starting pitcher, Marco Estrada, has really developed a nice rapport with him. So, you know, even though it's not the same impact he had on the team in 2014, Navarro's been a really nice piece for this team all year.
You mentioned Estrada, so let's go right into that. Eight scoreless innings against the Braves last Thursday, and then he comes back out. Another solid start against the Yankees this week. Where does he stand as far as the postseason rotation goes?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one of the biggest topics of conversation around here over the last couple of weeks, without a doubt. And I think, you know, the assumption not too long ago was that he'd probably be the odd man out and would probably transition back to that swingman type role in the bullpen that he's done in the past. He has some experience in it. He succeeded in it. And that was the original expectation. But the way he's been pitching for a really long period of time now, I think he's just done too good of a job to be slotted back in there. And now I think you're talking about a situation where he could take a starting job away from Mark Burley. You know, Mark Burley hasn't really looked like himself for, you know, almost about a month right now. He's just not, even though he's not really hurt per se, he's just kind of, in his words, banged up a little bit and just not feeling 100% healthy. And he's not a guy who throws a lot of velocity to begin with. And then when you lose even a little bit more, that can take an impact. Whereas, you know, Estrada has been everything the Blue Jays could have hoped for and more. You know, John Gibbons last week said in a lot of ways he saved their season, and you could certainly make that case because before all the big moves were made at the trade deadline, this is a team that was struggling for a couple months prior to that, and they really had a lot of uncertainty in the rotation. Estrada began the year in the bullpen, didn't get an opportunity until about a month in the season. But he came in and really solidified a lot. And, you know, during his first stretch, I was kind of waiting for him, for his production to kind of fall off and go back to some of his career norms. And, you know, I found myself saying that probably 3-4 weeks at a time. And Eventually you just have to start believing in what he's doing, because he's been able to do it time and time again. And on Tuesday night, it looked like it was going to be a rough night for him. I gave up two runs early, and you're thinking, well, this might be finally the time that he has a short outing. And what does he do after that? He bounces right back, and at one point retires 11 in a row, another quality start. He's just been doing it time and time again, and I think they need to find a spot for him in the rotation in the postseason, because that's what he's deserved.
One guy that we know will be in that postseason rotation, obviously David Price, 7 scoreless innings on Monday night. And when you look at what he's done with the Jays, not overall necessarily, but just against the Yankees, it really stands out. I mean, here's a guy that I know when you hear him talking things, you can almost tell that he has kind of a feel for the moment, and he knows when he's in a big game.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the Blue Jays, I mean, this is exactly what they brought him in for. And one of the first things that you kind of looked at after that trade deadline was how many games he was going to be matched up against the Yankees. And the Jays kind of finagled their schedule a little bit to maximize the amount of times he would face them. And now you're talking about a guy who's made 4 starts against the Yankees, 3-0, probably should be 4-0 if it wasn't for a bit of a bullpen issue in that 4th start. And, I mean, that really makes it all the difference. You look at a team going into play Wednesday night, and that was 2.5 up on the Yankees. I mean, that's the tail right there with the standings. And David Price has really been the difference maker. And it's rare that you see one player able to come in immediately and make that exact kind of impact against a division rival. But the schedule has worked out in their favor with regards to that, and Price has certainly worked out in terms of performance. And it just gives the Blue Jays just a completely different look with their rotation. And I think, you know, his presence more than anything is what has really rejuvenated a lot of people around here. And when you have that bona fide ace at the top of your rotation, he's a guy who's also won a lot of games already with the Blue Jays after a loss. And that's kind of what you look for in your ace. And he's delivered time and time again. The Jays really couldn't have asked for anything more from him either.
Briefly, after Monday night's game, the Red Sox were out of the cellar in the American League East. They had hopped over the Rays with a big victory. There's been times in the last week where it looked like they might end up in 3rd place. But overall, when you look at what the team's done and trying to climb their way out of the cellar, is that keeping this team kind of hungry late in the season, or do they not even care about the standings?
No, they care, because, look, it's a team with a lot of young players, so it's not like a bunch of guys who have been, playing a bunch of World Series. In that case, it would be a different story. But no, there's a lot of energy for guys trying to prove to Dave Dombrowski that they belong with this team long-term and that they're part of the solution. I just think the team has played with a great deal of energy overall, if you look at over the last month or so. So a very encouraging finish to the season, much unlike last year where things were just depressing here the last 2 months of the season. But a lot of things to smile about here at Red Sox fan these last 2 weeks, regardless of whether they do hop into 4th or 3rd. I think more than that, it's just kind of the way they're playing right now.
Yeah, and you would think that would help all these players heading into the offseason as they get into those workouts and everything, the grind of the offseason before getting back to Fort Myers next spring. Big home run, grand slam on Monday night for Xander Bogaerts, 7th homer of the year. Obviously, he's had a great season. After that, he was hitting .323 after that game on the season. Is there still belief on this team from a power standpoint that he could be a guy that hits maybe 15 to 20 homers per year? Because we haven't really seen that yet.
Yeah, you know what I mean? He hit 12 last year and probably could have hit more. He had a concussion on the sideline for a little bit. But no, I think he'll definitely going to hit for some more power. I mean, the power is clearly there. The grand slam he hit the other night was a rocket. So when he does hit the ball out of the ballpark, it's not like little punch and Judy shots. They're legitimate home runs. And it's just been one of those years, Tim, where there's been a lot of balls that have been knocked down by the wind at the top of the wall, just kind of a little bit snake bitten in the home run category. But yeah, they have every reason to think that this is a guy who's going to hit his 15 to 20, have a really good career. So, a lot of excitement, around this team about Xander Bogaerts.
There was a report this week also that Scott Boras saying that he wouldn't rule out an extension talks with the Red Sox as far as Bogaerts go. And obviously, Scott Boras in general, when we see him and his clients, they always seem to find their way to free agency. So it can't be a bad thing that he at least mentioned that he would consider an extension for Bogaerts and the Red Sox.
Yeah, I mean, I think reading between the lines, Scott's saying, if you want to just make me a ridiculous offer right now of 10 years and $200 million or something crazy like that, we'll be glad to take it. But, yeah, he's not going to take anything below a pretty exorbitant salary. So I think that's all he's saying. Like, look, you know, you can sign him, but be prepared to spend a lot of money and more money than you usually would on a 23-year-old kid at this point in time.
Yeah, and obviously free agency still a long way off for Bogaerts, so plenty of time to think about that. And that's not a discussion that'll probably happen anytime soon. Speaking of young players on this Red Sox team, Mookie Betts obviously has become a mainstay here in this outfield. The question is where in the outfield will Mookie end up, I guess, in 2016. But it sounds like he's going to consistently be in right field the rest of this season and see if that is kind of the place for him to finally end up for good.
Yeah, I think they're just trying to really get a feel for what works best here. And I think that, you know, Betts is certainly going to play right for the rest of his homestand. A chance he could go back to center for the season-ending road trip. But, you know, they just want to see how these guys best line up together. In my personal opinion, I like the alignment where Mookie's in center and Jackie's in right, because I think that, you know, especially in Fenway, I think you want your best arm to be in right field. And that, to me, is Jackie Bradley Jr. And I think in some ways right field is a tougher position at Fenway than center. So you want your best outfielder to be in center. I think Mookie is an excellent outfielder. I just think Jackie is probably just a little bit better out there. So that's the way I'd line up. But the one thing they have found out is that Ruznik Castillo looks like a natural left field. So that's made things easy for them, just to know that Ruznik is their left fielder going forward. So now they just have to decide between Betts and Bradley how that best lines up.
The Rays in Boston this week taking on the Red Sox, and after a loss on Monday, briefly dropped into last place, but then they quickly bounced back on Tuesday to leapfrog back over the Red Sox into fourth place in the AL East. And Matt Moore, after a tough first inning at Fenway, really settled in. How nice was it to see for Rays fans and for this team to see Moore really put together some solid innings? He ended up going 6 2/3 innings. He allowed just the 2 earned runs, both of those, though, in that first inning, and he gets the win in Boston.
Well, based on what we saw earlier in the summer when he returned to the team, very encouraging. His last two outings, he's allowed 2 runs in, I believe it's 13 2/3 innings, and you can just see a different body language about him. You know, I think he's feeling better. He's put the ball more where he wants to. And everybody knew it was going to be a journey coming back from Tommy John. And it looks like, you know, good for him and good for the Rays is that it looks like he's going to be able to turn the page before the end of the season so he can go into the offseason feeling good about himself. And the Rays can look at him as a good piece for their rotation next year.
When you look at the first inning of that game, then what he did after, did anything change for him there? Did the control improve from first inning to second inning, or did he just have some bad luck in the first inning?
Well, you know, I thought it looked to me like he was struggling with his command a little bit in the first inning. I mean, he threw 32 pitches. Of course, he struck out the side eventually, but he didn't let it defeat him. And, you know, to me, those are some of my favorite games to watch. When you see a guy go out there and struggle early and then knuckle down and finish the way he did. And I know he's got to be feeling, you know, pretty darn nice about it. Because, and ironically, Boston was the same site of where he threw his last major league game before getting sent down to the minors. And I remember him saying something to the effect that day that, you know, he was not going to let that defeat him. And, you know, to his credit, you know, he's followed suit. So he works hard to get, you know, to do what he has to do, and he's done a nice job of getting back.
I mentioned that the Rays were briefly into last place after Monday night's game. What is the mood in that clubhouse with a couple weeks to go here in the season?
You know, it's so funny. I get asked that question a lot. And you really, a clubhouse mood, you rarely see a change. And right now there's so many young faces in there. They're excited about playing. I know the coaches and manager are excited about seeing some of these young guys play, you know, and maybe forecast them to be critical parts next year. So, and if you're a fan, they're fun to watch right now. You know, even though they might not be winning the way you want them to, you know, kind of squinting your eyes and see some of the future out there right now.
Chris Archer reached 200 innings this season now. That's sort of a magic number, I think, when you're talking about a top-of-the-rotation starter and a guy who's going to be out there every fifth day and really give you innings. Bill, is that the sort of final checkbox filled in for Archer when you talk about him being a legitimate ace?
Oh, I totally think it is. I mean, I think, in my opinion, 200 innings is, you know, one of the it's a blue-collar, you know, badge of courage for starting pitchers, and it does so much for a staff when you have a guy give you 200 innings. I know the Rays had it 2 years in a row with Price and David Price and James Shields, and what it does is it allows you to rest your bullpen some on a lot of nights, and you know that way it allows you to end up using these guys in the bullpen more for matchups instead of killing innings, and it's just a really big deal, I think. And he's really, you know, he set his goals high, and he's met most of them.
Really out of the division race, probably, you know, looking like they're not heading to the postseason, but a fun series right now as far as the Battle of the Beltway. It gives the O's a chance to kind of play spoiler in the National League, which is something we've not really seen in baseball before, but they get to take on the Nationals and help maybe eliminate Washington from that NL East race. Kind of neat late in the season.
Well, yeah, I guess, Tim, you could look at it like that, although the Orioles are actually taking the opposite approach. They're even though it looks bleak because there are four teams ahead of them for that second wild card spot, they're only four down in the loss column to the Astros. And what they're looking at is if we can win as many games as possible, and what they're trying to do is run the table, whether they're going to be able to do that remains to be seen. They still think mathematically, until somebody tells them you're eliminated, that they're going to try to stay relevant in the race. And at the same time, it happens to be that they're playing the Nationals, who are in an even more dire position because the only way they can get at the postseason is if they pass the Mets. The way the Cubs and the Pirates have played in the NL Central, the wild card is definitely going to come out of that division, both of them. So the Nats really have to catch the Mets. And the Nats had to be pretty frustrated last night because the Orioles really played a sloppy game. They made three errors. There were two other plays that weren't made that could have been called errors and weren't. But the Nats only got three hits, and the Orioles won 4-1. And you looked up at the scoreboard to see that the Braves were dominating the Mets and the Nationals could have gained a game. What they're trying to do is get within three by the end of next week because they finished with three in New York. So if the Orioles are spoilers, I guess from the Nats standpoint, they could look at that. But from the Orioles standpoint, they're looking at it as we need as many wins as we can. And if it works out, we're in, fine. And if not, fine. But we're going to keep playing hard with our real team and our real lineup until we're eliminated.
I know overall you like to play those division games in September and battle it out for whatever you can get. But if you have to play interleague games, which obviously with the way baseball's aligned now you do, this is a pretty neat way to do it, to have a Beltway series. And we saw in New York last weekend a Subway series in September.
Yeah, the Nationals and the Orioles rivalry is growing certainly more so than when the Nationals first came here from Montreal. And in the early years of the rivalry, both these teams were bad, I mean, just to be honest about it. And it's only since 2012 that they've been relevant in their respective divisions. The only thing about the rivalry, and I wish the MLB schedule makers would take a closer look at this, with the natural rivalries, and we play the Nationals every year because they are our natural rival. Their ballpark is only 35 miles away from our ballpark. To me, this really should have been played on a weekend in August. The first go-round was a weekend in July at Camden Yards, the final series before the All-Star break, and they drew 137,000 fans to Camden Yards. Now, here we are in late September. School is back in session, and it was scheduled for a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday series, all-night games. So you're competing with parents not wanting to have their kids out on a school night. People have to work. Another coincidence, the Pope is in town here, so on the news they're telling you, look, if you don't have to be anywhere, stay home, so people are reluctant to go out. I think this would have had a little bit more more zing to it, if you will, if this was an August weekend series instead of in September. But I do agree with you, Tim. I mean, there has to be an interleague game all the way to the end of the year. I think the Angels drew the short straw. I think they play in Arizona the last 3 days of the season. And that's really tough because the American League team loses its DH when they go on the road in the interleague. But it is a growing rivalry, and I think the reason for that is that both these teams are very, very good. They're very well run by their front offices, and they each have an owner that is very competitive. So it's it really is a nice budding rivalry. But again, I just wish the schedule makers would look at these rival games and try to ensure that they're played in the summer on weekends so more people can attend, because I can guarantee you a lot of people would have come here from Baltimore to see the O's play at Nats Park because they love showing their orange on the road, especially when it's the rivalry game.
This has been MLB.com Extra's look inside the American League East. Tune in again next week.